a relationship, and there was no relationship there. When they were being killed, there wasn't anything going on in my mind, except that they were going to be mine. That was the only way they could be mine. In documented psychiatric sessions, he confessed to eating parts of the girls, another way to make them a part of him. They were like spirit wives. I still had their spirits. I still have them, he told the stunned psychiatrist. But in court, he later said he only told the psychiatrist that in order to bolster his insanity plea. Two, while others who included cannibalism in their crimes were usually found insane, consider Plainfield, Wisconsin's Ed Gein, who had body parts in a pot on his stove when police arrived at his home to arrest him. Kemper was too smart to fall into that category. During the trial, Kemper's taped confessions were played in the courtroom. I recall sitting in the courtroom at the trial, listening to the taped confessions, and looking at the faces of the parents of the murdered girls, just the shock and agony of what they had gone through, said Koenig, who covered the story. What a tragedy. Those families where a young woman was murdered and taken away. The tragedy of that is as much alive today as it was in 1972. Kemper himself also felt a hint of remorse during his trial, especially when the fathers of his first victims, Marianne Pesci and Alida Lucchesa, testified about the loss of their teenage daughters. The day those fathers testified in court was very hard for me, Kemper said in Front Page Detective. I felt terrible. I wanted to talk to them about their daughters, comfort them. But what could I say? The trial lasted less than 3 weeks, and on November 8, 1973, a 6-man, 6-woman jury deliberated for just 5 hours before finding Kemper sane and guilty of 8 counts of first-degree murder. I really wasn't surprised when it came out that way, Kemper said. There was just no way they could find me insane. Society just isn't ready for that yet. 10 or 20 years from now, they would have, but they're not going to take a chance. Kemper's prediction, made in March of 1974, was wrong. Dahmer, whose crimes somewhat mirrored those of Kemper's, although Dahmer murdered and dismembered boys rather than young girls to keep them close, was also found sane when he stood trial in 1992. He was sentenced to 7 years to life for each count, with his sentences to run concurrently. When the judge asked Kemper what he thought his punishment should be, he suggested death by torture, then asked for the death penalty. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court had put a moratorium on capital punishment at the time, so all death penalty cases were commuted to life in prison. He was incarcerated at California Medical Facility in Vacaville, California, where he remains. I gave up, he said. I came in out of the cold. A lot of people like it in the cold. Despite the depravity of Kemper's crimes, he has been up for parole 6 times, the first in 1980 when he was 31. He has been denied each time. Later, a magazine reporter for Cosmopolitan asked Kemper during a prison interview how he felt when he saw a pretty girl, and his response likely sealed his fate regarding any future parole possibilities. He said, "One side of me says, I'd like to talk to her, date her. The other side says, I wonder how her head would look on a stick." Kemper's life behind prison walls. In 1988, he and John Wayne Gacy, executed in 1994, participated in a satellite discussion with FBI agent Robert Ressler about the details of their crimes. Ressler, who interviewed Kemper many times afterwards, once ended up alone with Kemper, who nonchalantly asked him what police officials would think if they came in and found Ressler's head on the table. Ressler asked Kemper if he wouldn't get in trouble for it, and Kemper replied, "What will they do, cut off my TV privileges?" When Ressler left, Kemper allegedly poked his arm and said, "You know I was just kidding, right?" The seasoned FBI agent later described psychopaths like Kemper in this way. These are the kids who never learned it's wrong to poke out a puppy's eyes. At one point, Kemper asked for a lobotomy to potentially cure him of his compulsive urges for murder and sexual aggression. It would break the conditioning. It would give me a chance. It would eradicate it. But it would break it, he said. But his request was denied. Instead, Kemper became a model inmate, reading books on tape for the blind, but always recommended to his parole board that he should not be released from prison. Under incarceration, officials and other inmates say he is kind and willing to participate in interviews in hopes of determining why he committed his series of grisly crimes. A few years after he was arrested for the murders, Kemper sent Dr. William Schanberger, the psychiatrist he had spent some time with while incarcerated as a teen, a mug that took him a year to make. It was colorful with a bit of an abstract, Picasso-esque style, and it said on the side, "I beg your pardon," and on the bottom, "I never promised you a rose garden." Schanberger views the gift as an abject apology from a man who intensely longed to be normal. "I think there was a side of him that would have given anything to be a normal person," added Honig. "I saw that at the trial. Unfortunately, the mother who verbally abused her middle son and ignored the signs that her abuse was having a serious impact on his psyche made sure that normal was something Kemper would never be. I hope I can find a way to help other people," Kemper told Front Page Detective. "Maybe they can study me and find out what makes people like me do the things they do." Kemper made infamous through music. At least 6 bands worldwide have written songs immortalizing the crimes of the sadistic, depraved killer who has been behind bars since his arrest in 1973. The band Macabre wrote the song "Edmund Kemper Had a Horrible Temper," with lyrics that summed up his life of crime fairly well. At the age of 15, he murdered his grandparents. They put him away for only 7 years. He hated his mother, who worked at the college, so he picked up young hitchhiking co-eds and cut off their heads. "Edmund Kemper had a horrible temper. He cut off young girls' heads and took them home to bed. Edmund Kemper had a horrible temper. He cut off young girls' heads and took them home to bed. He'd pick up co-ed girls to give them a ride, then bring them to the forest at gunpoint. Edmund would stab them and sever off their heads. He'd take the heads home and have sex with them. Edmund Kemper had a horrible temper. He cut off young girls' heads and took them home to bed. Edmund Kemper had a horrible temper. He cut off young girls' heads and took them home to bed." Free bonus chapter. The Making of a Serial Killer. "I was born with the devil in me," said H.H. Holmes, who in 1893 took advantage of the World's Fair and the extra room he rented out in his Chicago mansion to kill at least 27 people without attracting much attention. "I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing. I was born with the evil one standing as my sponsor beside the bed where I was ushered into the world, and he has been with me since," Holmes said. The idea of "I can't help it" is one of the hallmarks of many serial killers, along with an unwillingness to accept responsibility for their actions and a refusal to acknowledge that they themselves used free will to do their dreadful deeds. "Yes, I did it, but I'm a sick man and can't be judged by the standards of other men," said Juan Corona, who killed 25 migrant workers in California in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Burying them in the very fruit orchards where they'd hoped to build a better life for their families. Dennis Rader, who called himself the BTK killer, bind, torture, kill, also blamed some unknown facet to his personality, something he called Factor X, for his casual ability to kill one family, then go home to his own, where he was a devoted family man. "When this monster entered my brain, I will never know, but it is here to stay. How does one cure himself? I can't stop it. The monster goes on and hurts me as well as society. Maybe you can stop him. I can't," said Rader, who said he realized he was different than the other kids before he entered high school. "I actually think I may be possessed with demons." But again, he blamed others for not stopping him from making his first murderous move. You know, at some point in time, someone should have picked something up from me and identified it, he later said. Rader was not the only serial killer to place the blame far away from himself. William Bonin actually took offense when a judge called him sadistic and guilty of monstrous criminal conduct. I don't think he had any right to say that to me, Bonin later whined. I couldn't help myself. It's not my fault I killed those boys. It leaves us always asking why. For those of us who are not serial killers, the question of why and how almost always come to mind. So ill-equipped are we to understand the concept of murder on such a vast scale. Some nights I'd lie awake asking myself, who the hell is this BTK? Said FBI profiler John Douglas, who worked the behavioral science unit at Quantico before writing several best-selling books, including Mindhunter, Inside the FBI's Elite Serial Crime Unit, and Obsession, the FBI's legendary profiler probes the psyches of killers, rapists, and stalkers, and their victims and tells how to fight back. The questions were never far from his mind. What makes a guy like this do what he does? What makes him tick? And it's the kind of thing that keeps profilers and police up at night, worrying, wondering, and waiting for answers that are not always so easily forthcoming. Another leader into the study of madmen, the late FBI profiler Robert Ressler, who coined the term serial killer as well as criminal profiling, also spent sleepless nights trying to piece together a portrait of many a killer, something that psychiatrist James Brussel did almost unfailingly well in 1940, when a pipe bomb killer enraged at Con Edison was terrorizing New York City. Brussel told police what the killer would be wearing when they arrested him, and although he was caught at home late at night, wearing his pajamas, when police asked him to dress, he emerged from his room wearing a double-breasted suit, exactly as Brussel had predicted. What is this force that takes a hold of a person and pushes them over the edge? Wondered Ressler, who interviewed scores of killers over the course of his illustrious career. In an effort to infiltrate the minds of serial killers, Douglas and Ressler embarked on a mission to interview some of the most deranged serial killers in the country, starting their journey in California, which has always had more than its share of weird and spectacular crimes, Douglas said. In their search for a pattern, they determined that there are essentially two types of serial killers, organized and disorganized. Organized killers. Organized killers were revealed through their crime scenes, which were neat, controlled, and meticulous, with effort taken both in the crime and with their victims. Organized killers also take care to leave behind few clues once they're done. Dean Corll was an organized serial killer. He tortured his victims overnight, carefully collecting blood and bodily fluids on a sheet of plastic before rolling them up and burying them and their possessions, most beneath the floor of a boat shed he'd rented, going there late at night under the cover of darkness. Disorganized killers. On the flip side of the coin, disorganized killers grab their victims indiscriminately or act on the spur of the moment, allowing victims to collect evidence beneath their fingernails when they fight back and oftentimes leaving behind numerous clues, including weapons. The disorganized killer has no idea of or interest in the personalities of his victims, Ressler wrote in his book, Whoever Fights Monsters, one of several detailing his work as a criminal profiler. He does not want to know who they are, and many times takes steps to obliterate their personalities by quickly knocking them unconscious or covering their faces or otherwise disfiguring them. Carrie Stainer, also known as the Yosemite Killer, became a disorganized killer during his last murder, which occurred on the fly when he was unable to resist a pretty park educator. Lucky for other young women in the picturesque park, he left behind a wide range of clues, including four unmatched tire tracks from his aging 1979 International Scout. The crime scene is presumed to reflect the murderer's behavior and personality in much the same way as furnishings reveal the homeowner's character. Douglas and Ressler later wrote, expanding on their findings as they continued their interview sessions. Serial killers think they're unique, but they're not. Dr. Helen Morrison, a longtime fixture in the study of serial killers, who keeps clown killer John Wayne Gacy's brain in her basement after Gacy's execution, she sent the brain away for an analysis that proved it to be completely normal, said that at their core, most serial killers are essentially the same. While psychologists still haven't determined the motives behind what drives serial killers to murder, there are certain characteristics they have in common, said Morrison, who has studied or interviewed scores of serial killers and wrote about her experiences in My Life Among the Serial Killers. Most often men, serial killers tend to be talkative hypochondriacs who develop a remorseless addiction to the brutality of murder. Two, they are able to see their victims as inanimate objects, playthings, if you will, around simply for their amusement. Empathy? Not on your life. They have no appreciation for the absolute agony and terror and fear that the victim is demonstrating, said Morrison. They just see the object in front of them. A serial murderer has no feelings. Serial killers have no motives. They kill only to kill an object. In doing so, they satisfy their urges and quiet the tumultuous turmoil inside of them. You say to yourself, how could anybody do this to another human being? Morrison said. Then you realize they don't see them as humans. To them, it's like pulling the wings off a fly or the legs off a daddy long legs. You just want to see what happens. It's the most base experiment. Nature versus nurture. For many serial killers, the desire to kill is as innate as their hair or eye color, and out of control, but most experts say that childhood trauma is an experience shared by them all. In 1990, Colin Wilson and Donald Seaman conducted a study of serial killers behind bars and found that childhood problems were the most influential factors that led serial killers down their particular path of death and destruction. Former FBI profiler Robert Ressler, who coined the term serial killer and criminal profiling, goes so far as to say that 100% of all serial killers experienced childhoods that were not filled with happy memories of camping trips or fishing on the lake. According to Ressler, of all the serial killers he interviewed or studied, each had suffered some form of abuse as a child, either sexual, physical, or emotional abuse, neglect or rejection by parents, or humiliation, including instances that occurred at school. For those who are already hovering psychologically on edge due to unfortunate genetics, such events become focal points that drive a killer to act on seemingly insane instincts. Because there is often no solid family unit, parents are missing or more focused on drugs and alcohol. Sexual abuse goes unnoticed. Physical abuse is commonplace. The child's development becomes stunted, and they can either develop deep-seated rage or create for themselves a fantasy world where everything is perfect and they are essentially the kings of their self-made castle. That was the world of Jeffrey Dahmer, who recognized his need for control much later, after hours spent in analysis, where he learned the impact of a sexual assault as a child, as well as his parents' messy, rage-filled divorce. After I left home, that's when I started wanting to create my own little world, where I was the one who had complete control, Dahmer said. I just took it way too far. Dahmer's experiences suggest that psychopathic behavior likely develops in childhood, when due to neglect and abuse, children revert to a place of fantasy, a world where the victimization of the child shifts toward others. The child becomes sociopathic, because the normal development of the concepts of right and wrong and empathy towards others is retarded because the child's emotional and social development occurs within his self-centered fantasies. A person can do no wrong in his own world, and the pain of others is of no consequence when the purpose of the fantasy world is to satisfy the needs of one person, according to one expert. As the lines between fantasy and reality become blurred, fantasies that on their own are harmless become real, and monsters like Dean Corll find themselves strapping young boys down to a wooden board, raping them, torturing them and listening to them scream, treating the act like little more than a dissociative art project that ends in murder. Going inside the mind, psychopathy, and other mental illnesses. While not all psychopaths are serial killers, many compulsive killers do feel some sense of remorse, such as Green River killer Gary Ridgway did when he cried in court after one victim's father offered Ridgway his forgiveness. Those who are, Morrison said, are unable to feel a speck of empathy for their victims. Their focus is entirely on themselves and the power they are able to assert over others, especially so in the case of a psychopath. Psychopaths are charming. Think Ted Bundy, who had no trouble luring young women into his car by eliciting sympathy with a faked injury, and have the skills to easily manipulate their victims, or in some cases, their accomplices. Dean Corll was called a Svengali, a name taken from a fictional character in Georges du Maurier's 1895 novel Trilby, who seduces, dominates, and exploits the main character, a young girl, for being able to enlist the help of several neighborhood boys who procured his youthful male victims without remorse, even when the teens were their friends. Some specific traits of serial killers, determined through years of profiling, include smooth-talking but insincere. Ted Bundy was a charmer, the kind of guy that made it easy for people to be swept into his web. I liked him immediately, but people like Ted can fool you completely, said Anne Rule, author of the best-selling Stranger Beside Me, about her experiences with Bundy, a man she considered a friend. I'd been a cop, had all that psychology, but his mask was perfect. I say that long acquaintance can help you know someone, but you can never be really sure. Scary. Egocentric and grandiose. Jack the Ripper thought the world of himself, and felt he would outsmart police, so much so that he sent letters taunting the London officers. Dear boss, he wrote, I'll keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real fits. I am down on oars, and I shan't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue, and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. Ha ha! The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get a chance. Good luck. Lack of remorse or guilt. Joel Rifkin was filled with self-pity after he was convicted of killing and dismembering at least 9 women. He called his conviction a tragedy, but later, in prison, he got into an argument with mass murderer Colin Ferguson over whose killing spree was more important. And when Ferguson taunted him for killing women, Rifkin said, yeah, but I had more victims. Lack of empathy. Andre Chikatilo, who feasted on bits of genitalia, both male and female, after his kills, thought nothing of taking a life, no matter how torturous it was for his victims. The whole thing, the cries, the blood, the agony, gave me relaxation and a certain pleasure, he said. Deceitful and manipulative. John Wayne Gacy refused to take responsibility for the 28 boys buried beneath his house, even though he also once said that clowns can get away with murder. I think after 14 years under truth serum, had I committed the crime, I would have known it, said the man the neighbors all claimed to like. There's got to be something that would click in my mind. I've had photos of 21 of the victims, and I've looked at them all over the years here, and I've never recognized any one of them. Shallow emotions. German serial killer Rudolf Pleyel, convicted of killing 10 people and later took his own life in prison, compared his hobby of murder to playing cards, and later told police, "What I did is not such a great harm, with all these surplus women nowadays. Anyway, I had a good time." Impulsive. Tommy Lynn Sells, who claimed responsibility for dozens of murders throughout the Midwest and South, saw a woman at a convenience store and followed her home, an impulse he was unable to control. He waited until the house went dark. "Then, I went into this house. I go to the first bedroom I see. I don't know whose room it is, and I start stabbing." The victim was the woman's young son. Poor behavior controls. "I wish I could stop, but I could not. I had no other thrill or happiness," said UK killer Dennis Nilsson, who killed at least 12 young men via strangulation, then bathed and dressed their bodies before disposing of them, often by burning them. Need for excitement. For Albert Fish, a masochistic killer with a side of sadism that included sending a letter to the mother of one of his victims, describing in detail how he cut, cooked, and ate her daughter, even the idea of his own death was one he found particularly thrilling. "Going to the electric chair will be the supreme thrill of my life," he said. Lack of responsibility. "I see myself more as a victim rather than a perpetrator," said Gacy, in a rare moment of admitting the murders. "I was cheated out of my childhood. I should never have been convicted of anything more serious than running a cemetery without a license. They were just a bunch of worthless little queers and punks." Early behavior problems. "When I was a boy, I never had a friend in the world," said German serial killer Heinrich Pomerenk, who began raping and murdering girls as a teen. Adult antisocial behavior. Gary Ridgway pleaded guilty to killing 48 women, mostly prostitutes, who were easy prey and were rarely reported missing, at least not immediately. "I don't believe in man, God, nor devil. I hate the whole damn human race, including myself. I preyed upon the weak, the harmless, and the unsuspecting. This lesson I was taught by others. Might makes right. I felt like it." Many psychopaths will say after a crime, "I did it because I felt like it," with a certain element of pride. That's how BTK killer Dennis Rader felt, and because he had no sense of wrong regarding his actions, he was able to carry on with his normal life, with his wife and children, with ease. Someone else's demeanor might have changed. They may have become jittery or anxious, and they would have been caught. Many serial killers are so cold, they can pop into a diner right after a murder, never showing a sign of what they've done. Serial murderers often seem normal, according to the FBI. They have families and/or a steady job. "They're so completely ordinary," Morrison added. "That's what gets a lot of victims in trouble. That normalcy is often what allows perpetrators to get away with their crimes for so long. Unlike mass murderers, such as terrorists, who generally drop off the radar before perpetrating their event, serial killers blend in. They might seem a bit strange. Neighbors noticed that Ed Gein wasn't too big on personal hygiene, and neighbors didn't think it was odd that William Bonin hung out with such young boys, but not so much that anyone would ask too many questions. That's why so many people often say, "I had no idea," or, "He was such a nice guy," after a friend or neighbor is arrested. And it's also why people are so very, very stunned when they see stories of serial killers dominating the news. For a person with a conscience, Rader's crimes seem hideous. But from his point of view, these are his greatest accomplishments, and he is anxious to share all of the wonderful things he has done, said Jack Levin, Ph.D., director of the Brudnick Center on Violence and Conflict at Northeastern University in Boston and the author of Extreme Killings. A new take on psychopathy. Psychopathy is now diagnosed as antisocial personality disorder, a prettier spin on an absolutely horrifying diagnosis. According to studies, almost 50% of men in prison and 21% of women in prison have been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. Of serial killers, Ted Bundy, who enjoyed sex with his dead victims, John Wayne Gacy, and Charles Manson, who encouraged others to do his dirty work, which included the murder of pregnant Sharon Tate, were all diagnosed with this particular affliction, which allowed them to carry out their crimes with total disregard toward others or toward the law. They showed no remorse. Schizophrenia. Many known serial killers were later diagnosed with some form of mental illness, including schizophrenia, believed to be behind the crimes of David Berkowitz. He said his neighbor's dog told him to kill his six victims in the 70s. Ed Gein, whose grisly saving of skin, bones, and various female sex parts was a desperate effort to resurrect his dead mother, and Richard Chase, the vampire of Sacramento, who killed six people in California in order to drink their blood. Schizophrenia includes a wide range of symptoms, ranging from hallucinations and delusions to living in a catatonic state. Borderline personality disorder. Borderline personality disorder, which is characterized by intense mood swings, problems with interpersonal relationships, and impulsive behaviors, is also common in serial killers. Some diagnosed cases of borderline personality disorder include Aileen Warrenos, a woman whose horrific childhood and numerous sexual assaults led her to murder one of her rapists, after which she spiraled out of control and killed six other men who picked her up along the highway in Florida. Nurse Kristen H. Gilbert, who killed four patients at a Virginia hospital with overdoses of epinephrine and Dahmer, whose murder count rose to 17 before he was caught. With a stigma still quite present regarding mental illness, it's likely we will continue to diagnose serial killers and mass murderers after the fact, too late to protect their victims. Top signs of a serial killer. While there is still no simple thread of similarities, which is why police and the FBI have more trouble in real life solving crimes than they do on shows like Criminal Minds, there are some things to look for, experts say. Antisocial behavior. Psychopaths tend to be loners, so if a child that was once gregarious and outgoing becomes shy and antisocial, this could be an issue. Jeffrey Dahmer was a social, lively child until his parents moved to Ohio for his father's new job. There, he regressed, allegedly after being sexually molested, and began focusing his attentions on dissecting roadkill rather than developing friendships. Arson. Fire is power, and power and control are part of the appeal for serial killers who enjoy having their victims at their mercy. David Berkowitz was a pyromaniac as a child. His classmates called him Pyro as a nickname. So well known was he for his fire obsession, and he reportedly started more than 1,000 fires in New York before he became the Son of Sam killer. Torturing animals. Serial killers often start young and test boundaries with animals, including family or neighborhood pets. According to studies, 70% of violent offenders have episodes of animal abuse in their childhood histories, compared to just 6% of nonviolent offenders. Albert DeSalvo, better known as the Boston Strangler, would capture cats and dogs as a child and trap them in boxes, shooting arrows at the defenseless animals for sport. A troubled family history. Many serial killers come from families with criminal or psychiatric histories or alcoholism. Edmund Kemper killed his grandparents to see what it would be like, and later, after he murdered a string of college students, he killed his alcoholic mother, grinding her vocal cords in the garbage disposal in an attempt to erase the sound of her voice. Childhood abuse. William Bonin, who killed at least 21 boys and young men in violent rapes and murders, was abandoned as a child, sent to live in a group home where he himself was sexually assaulted. The connections suggest either a rage that can't be erased. Aileen Warrenos, a rare female serial killer, was physically and sexually abused throughout her childhood, resulting in distrust of others and a pent-up rage that exploded during a later rape, or a dissociation of sorts, refusing to connect on a human level with others, for fear of being rejected yet again. Substance abuse. Many serial killers use drugs or alcohol. Jeffrey Dahmer was discharged from the Army due to a drinking problem he developed in high school, and he used alcohol to lure his victims to his apartment, where he killed them in a fruitless effort to create a zombie-like sex slave who would never leave him. Voyeurism. When Ted Bundy was a teen, he spent his nights as a peeping Tom, hoping to get a glimpse of one of the neighborhood girls getting undressed in their bedrooms. Serial killers are usually smart. While their IQ is not usually the reason why serial killers elude police for so long, many have very high IQs. Edmund Kemperer was this close to being considered a genius. His IQ was 136, just 4 points beneath the 140 mark that earns genius status, and he used his intelligence to create complex cons that got him released from prison early after killing his grandparents, allowing 8 more women to die. Can't keep a job. Serial killers often have trouble staying employed, either because their off-hours activities take up a lot of time. Jeffrey Dahmer hid bodies in his shower, the shower he used every morning before work, because he was killing at such a fast rate, or because their obsessions have them hunting for victims when they should be on the clock. Trademarks of a serial killer. While what we know helps us get a better understanding of potential serial killers, and perhaps take a closer look at our weird little neighbors, it is still tricky for police and FBI agents to track serial killers down without knowing a few tells. The signature. While serial killers like to stake a claim over their killings, serial killers typically have some sort of a signature, according to Dr. Scott Bahn, a professor at Drew University in New Jersey. They are usually still quite neat, and a signature does not necessarily mean evidence. Jack the Ripper, of course, his signature was the ripping of the bodies, said Bahn. While there are multiple theories, Jack the Ripper has yet to be identified, despite the similarities in his murders. 2. The Happy Face Killer, Keith Hunter Jesperson, whose childhood was marked by alcoholic parents, teasing at school, and a propensity to abuse small animals, drew happy faces on the numerous letters he sent to both media and authorities, teasing them a bit with a carrot on a string. If the forensic evidence itself, depending upon the bones or flesh or whatever is left, if it allows for that sort of identification, that would be one way of using forensic evidence to link these murders, Bond said. The cooling off period. Organized killers are so neat, tidy, and meticulous that they may never leave clues, even if they have a signature. And if there's a cooling-off period between crimes, tracking the killer becomes even more of a challenge. After a murder, which could be compared to a sexual experience or getting high on drugs, the uncontrollable urges that led the killer to act dissipate, or at least temporarily. But according to Ressler, serial killers are rarely satisfied with their kills, and each one increases desire, in the same way a porn addiction can start with the pages of Playboy, then turn into BDSM videos or other fetishes that Playboy pictorials are no longer satisfying. I was literally singing to myself on my way home after the killing. The tension, the desire to kill a woman had built up in such explosive proportions that when I finally pulled the trigger, all the pressures, all the tensions, all the hatred had just vanished, dissipated, but only for a short time, said David Berkowitz, better known as the Son of Sam. Afterwards, the memory of the murder, or mementos from the murder, such as the skulls Jeffrey Dahmer retained, the scalps collected by David Gore, or the box of vulvas Ed Gein kept in his kitchen, no longer became enough, and the killers must kill again, creating a serial cycle. That window between crimes usually becomes smaller, however, which allows authorities to notice similarities in murder scenes or methodology, making tracking easier. In the case of William Bonin, there were months between his first few murders, but toward the end, he sometimes killed 2 young men a day to satisfy his increasingly uncontrollable urges. Sometimes I'd get tense and think I was going to go crazy if I couldn't get some release, like my head would explode. So I'd go out hunting. Killing helped me. It was like needing to go gambling or getting drunk. I had to do it, Bonin said. Hunting in pairs. Some serial killers, between 10 and 25%, find working as a team more efficient, and they use their charm as the hook to lure in accomplices. Ed Gein may never have killed anyone had his accomplice, a mentally challenged man who helped Gein dig up the graves of women who resembled his mother, not been sent to a nursing home, leaving Gein unable to dig up the dead on his own. Texas killer Dean Corll used beer, drugs, money, and candy to bribe neighborhood boys to bring him their friends for what they were promised was a party, but instead would turn to torture and murder. He would have killed many more if one of his accomplices had not finally shot him to prevent another night of death. William Bonin also liked to work with friends, and he enticed boys who were reportedly on the low end of the IQ scale to help him sadistically rape and torture his victims. Other red flags. According to the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit, founded by Robert Ressler, 60% of murderers whose crimes involved sex were childhood bedwetters and sometimes carried the habit into adulthood. One such serial killer, Alton Coleman, regularly wet his pants, earning the humiliating nickname Pissy. Sexual arousal over violent fantasies during puberty can also play a role in a serial killer's future. Jeffrey Dahmer hit puberty about the same time he was dissecting roadkill, so in some way, his wires became crossed and twisted, and sex and death aroused him. Brain damage? Maybe. While Helen Morrison's test found that John Wayne Gacy's brain was normal, and Jeffrey Dahmer's father never had the opportunity to have his son's brain studied, although both he and Jeffrey had wanted the study, there is some evidence that some serial killers have brain damage that impact their ability to exact rational control. Normal parents? Normal brains? I think not, said Dr. Jonathan Pincus, a neurologist and author of the book Base Instincts, What Makes Killers Kill. Abusive experiences, mental illnesses, and neurological deficits interplay to produce the tragedies reported in the newspapers. The most vicious criminals have also been, overwhelmingly, people who have been grotesquely abused as children and have paranoid patterns of thinking, said Pincus in his book, adding that childhood traumas can impact the developmental anatomy and functioning of the brain. So what do we know? Serial killers can be either uber-smart or brain-damaged, completely people-savvy or totally awkward, high-functioning and seemingly normal, or unable to hold down a job. But essentially, no matter what their backstory, their modus operandi, or their lifestyle, they're evil, said criminal profiler Pat Brown. And do we need to know anything more than that? Thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed Edmund Kemper, The True Story of the Coed Killer by Jack Rosewood, Historical Serial Killers and Murderers, True Crime by Evil Killers, Volume 2, written by Jack Rosewood, read to you by Miles Taylor. Copyright 2015 by Oscar Johansson. Production copyright 2016. By Oscar Johansson.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.